another Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we're enlightening you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories are set to hold talks in Vienna. Tehran says it is determined to take steps for the removal of U.S. sanctions. Saudi warplanes launched several airstrikes on the international airport in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. President Nicolas Maduro lashes out at EU observers of Venezuelan local elections and denies their assertion that a voting was marred by irregularities. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal says the discussions will be focused on the removal of anti-Tehran sanctions. Ali Bagheri Kani called the U.S. sanctions tyrannical and illegal. The deputy foreign minister said Iran is strongly determined to end the restrictions and is prepared to take serious steps in that regard. Bagheri also expressed hope that the discussions are effective in helping Iran achieve its purpose. He noted that the negotiating parties will use the opening day of the talks on Monday to set a framework for the discussions. Earlier, Bagheri held what he described as helpful talks with his Chinese and Russian counterparts and the representative of the European Union in the Vienna negotiations.
The talks in Vienna mark a new round of negotiations between Iran and the P4 plus 1, the group of remaining signatories to the nuclear accord after the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. The core issue for Tehran is the removal of the sanctions Washington has imposed on Iran ever since. Iran says it wants to see the sanctions removed all at once before the country returns to full compliance with its own obligations, because it was the U.S. that triggered the spiral down to the current situation by abandoning the nuclear agreement.
What is the center of focus in Vienna will be removing sanctions that have been imposed against Iran in a unilateral, extraterritorial, tyrannical, and illegal manner. The only thing that would help the U.S. is admitting that it's to blame for the current situation. It should remove the sanctions and give us a firm guarantee.
Iran says the talks can even lead to an immediate agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says what the U.S. needs to do is to fully return to its obligations and walk back the sanctions in a verifiable manner. Amir Abdullahian told the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, that sufficient and strict guarantees are also needed to ensure that a future U.S. government will not pull out of the deal again. Washington, however, has indicated that it's not ready to take those steps.
Let's see what they say when they're at the table. But obviously the indications they've given are not particularly encouraging. If those are the kinds of demands they make, that's tantamount to saying we don't really want a deal. We just want to spend the next few months building our nuclear program.
Iran began rolling back its commitments under the nuclear deal a year after the U.S. withdrawal and amid European signatories' failure to compensate for Washington's pullout. Iran originally accepted the accord's restrictions on its nuclear program in return for the economic benefits the removal of sanctions offered. However, those benefits never fully materialized due to Washington's continued pressure on Iran's potential economic partners. With sanctions back in full force under Donald Trump, Iran saw no point in unilaterally fulfilling its commitments. The country has repeatedly said even the rollback of its commitments fall strictly within the terms stated in Article 37 of the nuclear deal.
Iran has stated that if sanctions are reinstated in whole or in part, Iran will treat that as grounds to cease performing its commitments under this JCPOA in whole or in part.
Tehran says it's ready for a full return to its commitments if other signatories do the same. However, the administration of Joe Biden, who was the U.S. vice president when the nuclear deal was signed, has been dragging its feet, driving Iran to stand its ground on the outcome it wants to see out of the talks.
Iran is marking the 11th anniversary of the assassination of its nuclear scientist, Majid Shahriari. He was one of several Iranian scientists assassinated in just over a decade with Iran, pointing the finger at Israel and the U.S. Here's a report.
The aftermath of a brazen assassination on the streets of Tehran 11 years ago. The target was not a political figure, as one might expect, but a scientist. Majid Shahriari was on his way to university on November 29, 2010, when assassins on a motorbike attached explosives to his car and detonated them, killing him in cold blood just days before his 44th birthday.
The scientific garden that has been cultivated in Iran by the grace of God and diligence of the people is boundless. If they scythe any flower, many will grow in its place. They made a mistake. They have tested us many times. The 1980s Iraqi imposed war is a sign of that. Where are we now? Where is the other side?
Shahriari was a nuclear science and technology professor at Shahid Beheshti University. He studied at Amir Kabir and Sharif Universities of Technology, two prestigious universities in the Iranian capital. His expertise covered a wide array of nuclear scientific fields, including reactors, fuel cycles, and radiotherapy engineering. He was involved in designing and constructing nuclear reactor core simulators. On the day that Shahriari was assassinated, a similar attempt was made on the life of another Iranian nuclear scientist, Feridun Abbasi, but he miraculously survived. Those attacks came just months after the killing of another nuclear scientist, Masoud Ali Mohammadi. Two other experts, Daryush Rezai Nejad and Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan, were also assassinated in the next 2 years. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, killed near the Iranian capital last year, was the latest in the string of such assassinations. Iranian officials have blamed Israel for carrying out the assassinations with the complicity of the U.S., and the terrorist Mujahideen Akhar organization. Numerous Western reports have confirmed the veracity of the claim, while Israeli officials have never denied culpability. The intention of the killings has been described as impeding Iran's nuclear program, a campaign that has also included sanctions and acts of sabotage against Iranian nuclear facilities. Yet that objective has ostensibly not been achieved, as Iran's nuclear program is pushing ahead full steam. Just earlier this year, Iran unveiled 133 new nuclear achievements to mark the 15th anniversary of the National Nuclear Technology Day. The country has also recently ascended from observer state to full member status at the UN Scientific Committee on Effects of Atomic Radiation. Even US officials have admitted to such progress. A report earlier this month by the New York Times said US officials have warned Israel against carrying out attacks on Iranian nuclear sites. They say such acts of aggression are counterproductive and prompt Iran to rebuild an even more sophisticated and efficient uranium enrichment system. Upon visiting Shahriari's family in the wake of his assassination, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the assassinations are a sign that Iranians are conquering the summits of science and knowledge, and called for the continuation of their path. As evidenced by the advances and breakthroughs in the nuclear sector, Iranian officials and scientists have taken meticulous note of that advice.
Honorable Barry Grossman, international lawyer and activist, joins us via Skype out of the island of Bali in Indonesia. It's good to have you with us, Barry Grossman. Of course, 11 years on since the assassination of Professor Shahriari and where Iran is today in terms of its nuclear technology, do you think that those assassinations met their intended target?
Well, in the narrow sense of the term, they clearly did. And it's rather unfortunate that at the very least, what we've seen is five successful assassinations targeting Iranian scientists, including one back in 2007, which even Stratfor, the U.S. Security organization, claimed was carried out by the Mossad in the form of a poisoning. So it's very clear that there has been some success in targeted assassinations, but of course, Israel and its partners in the wider axis of evil, that is the United States and France, have fallen very wide of the mark in achieving their overall objective and somehow convincing the international community and people around the world that Iran is somehow in violation of its international obligations and quietly beavering away at creating some kind of a nuclear weapons facility. That's simply false, and they've certainly done nothing that could be characterized as achieving a goal of stopping such developments or even stopping Iran's peaceful nuclear ambitions, while at the same time, Israel, of course, remains largely untouchable, with no one being willing to hold Israel accountable for the very large stockpile of nuclear and chemical weapons, which it's largely conceded by all involved it has, even if Israel itself chooses to remain silent about those matters. So they've certainly killed people. And making it all the more egregious, they very often use terrorist organizations like MEC to do so in order to target people which even the Western media has said are not political and not involved in any kinds of a weapons program, and largely gotten away with it while falling far afield of somehow stopping Iran's scientific achievements and advancement in its peaceful nuclear program.
Many, many thanks, Honorable Barry Grossman, international lawyer and activist out of Bali. It was good to talk to you. Saudi warplanes launch air raids against Yemen's main international airport in the capital, Sana'a. Local media say the warplanes targeted the airport three times on Sunday night. This is the latest of such attacks this week against Sana'a Airport. Yemen's National Salvation Government says the strikes further complicate international humanitarian assistance into the country. An all-out blockade by the Saudi-backed coalition forced that as the closure of the airport to all but a few UN flights 5 years ago. The measure, among many others, has devastated Yemen after the launch of the Saudi-led war in 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have also been killed and many more have been displaced. Now, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slams EU observers who monitored the country's last week elections, branding them as spies.
Pia.
A delegation of spies, they weren't observers, wandered freely around the country, spying on the country's social, economic, and political life. They were not international observers. What we saw in the European Union delegation is something we hadn't seen in 22 years.
Maduro said the EU observers failed to tarnish the electoral process while stressing that the procedure was impeccable and democratic. Venezuelans went to the polls on November the 21st in local elections. Candidates supporting the Maduro government were declared the winners in the vast majority of cases. Opposition parties also took part in the polls for the first time since 2017, ending a string of boycotts. The EU observers' mission claimed that it noticed a lack of adherence to the rule of law and also questioned the transparency of the elections. Preliminary results from the Honduran presidential election show leftist opposition candidate Xiomara Castro is leading the race. The National Electoral Council says over 27% of the votes are counted. The council says Castro has so far secured more than 53% of the ballots. Her rival, Nasri Asfora, from the ruling National Party, had over 33% of the votes. Both parties have claimed victory, but authorities say more time is needed to declare the result. The election saw one of the highest amounts, turnouts, I should say, in the country in decades. If elected, Castro would be the first woman to lead Honduras. Her presidency would also end a dozen years of conservative rule over the country. Castro's husband, Manuel Zelaya, was the last leftist leader of Honduras. He was deposed in a coup in 2009. More countries announced they have detected the new and potentially mutable coronavirus strain that it could prolong the fight against the pandemic. The Netherlands has reported 13 cases of the new strain that was first detected in South Africa. Those who have recently returned from the African country. France says it has detected 8 possible cases, while Germany and Denmark have confirmed 3 and 2 cases. Risks say they are expecting more. Australia, Hong Kong, and imposing travel bans. Organization has described Omicron as highly contagious. There are also concerns that it could resist vaccines. Let's hope that is not the case. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The limelight.
As rich countries hoard doses and Big Pharma refuses to share the knowledge required to ramp up manufacturing, Cuba's public biotech sector could play a key role in defeating vaccine apartheid. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Cuba's homegrown COVID-19 vaccines poised to protect millions in poor nations. Stay tuned for more. Despite the added challenges created by a six-decade-long U.S. blockade, Cuba's public biotech sector has developed two highly effective vaccines, and its universal healthcare system has inoculated 4/5 of its population. Additionally, the island has begun exporting its homegrown doses and is on the verge of sharing its recipes with impoverished nations, abandoned by Big Pharma, and wealthy countries. Cuba is now one of the few lower-income countries to have not only vaccinated a majority of its population, Jacobins Branco wrote recently, but the only one to have done so with a vaccine it developed on its own. According to our rolling data, Cuba has fully vaccinated 80% of its population against COVID-19, putting it in the top 10 globally and well ahead of several wealthy nations. Nearly 90% of Cubans have received at least one dose, again outpacing most of the world. Even as the Biden administration has intensified Washington's embargo on the island, stifling its economy and depriving its residents of food and medical supplies, including syringes. Branco wrote, Cuba has been able to do the unthinkable, developing its own vaccine and are doing much of the developed role in overcoming the pandemic, despite its size and level of wealth, and despite a policy of concerted economic strangulation from a hostile government off its shores. He added that international solidarity efforts have been vital too, when the U.S. blockade meant a shortage of syringes on the island, jeopardizing its vaccination campaign. Solidarity groups from the United States alone sent 6 million syringes to Cuba, with the Mexican government sending 800,000 more, and more than 100,000 on top of that coming from Cubans in China. Since a late August peak of nearly 10,000 cases and almost 100 deaths per day, Cuba's successful vaccination effort has coincided with a major decline in coronavirus infections and mortality. While COVID-19 has claimed the lives of 8,295 Cubans since the pandemic began, the country recorded zero deaths from the disease. Moreover, the country reopened its borders on November 15th to tourism, roughly a tenth of its economy, and has reopened the schools. This makes Cuba an outlier among low-income countries, which have vaccinated only 2.8% of their combined populations. The glaring gap in vaccination rates between rich and poor countries is a result of vaccine hoarding by wealthy governments, which have gobbled up most of the world's doses, occasionally wasting excess supplies even as they tout their insufficient donations and pharmaceutical corporations' refusal to share vaccine formulas, even though the underlying technology is publicly funded. While health justice advocates continue to push for a temporary suspension of deadly intellectual property barriers at the World Trade Organization, a widely supported move that would enable qualified manufacturers to produce generic COVID-19 vaccines, treatments, and tests, Big Pharma has lobbied to maintain its extremely profitable monopoly control over life-saving knowledge. And the industry continues to be backed by the UK, Germany, and a few other opponents of the patent waiver. As that struggle continues ahead of the WTO's biannual ministerial conference that begins on November 30, Branco argued that Cuba's domestic vaccine production suggests a path forward for the developing world as it continues struggling with the pandemic in the face of ongoing corporate-driven vaccine apartheid, and points more broadly to what's possible when medical science is decoupled from private profits. Branco attributed Cuba's successful inoculation drive to the country's decision to develop its own vaccines, two of which Abdallah named for a poem penned by an independent hero, and Soberana II, Spanish for sovereign, were finally given official regulatory approval in July and August. He said, in the words of Vicente Vérez Bencomo, the internationally acclaimed head of the country's Finale Vaccine Institute, the country was betting it safe by waiting longer to manufacture its own vaccines. This way, it would avoid dependence on bigger allies while adding a new commercial export at a time of ongoing economic hardship. These efforts are already underway. Vietnam, with only 39% of its population fully vaccinated, inked a deal to buy 5 million vaccine doses, with Cuba recently shipping more than 1 million of them to its communist ally, 150,000 of which were donated. Venezuela, 32% fully vaccinated, also agreed to buy $12 million worth of the three-dose vaccine and has already started administering it, while other countries have agreed to partner with the country to develop their own homegrown vaccines. Syria, 4.2%, has recently discussed with Cuban officials the prospect of doing the same. The two vaccines are part of a suite of five COVID vaccines Cuba is developing. That includes a vaccine delivered nasally that's progressed to phase second of clinical studies, one of only five vaccines in the entire world that have a nasal application, according to one of its top scientists, that could be particularly useful if proven to be safe and effective given the virus's entry through the nasal cavity. It also includes a booster shot specially designed to work for those already inoculated with other vaccines, and which was recently trialed on Italian tourists. Since September, Cuba's been in the process of getting World Health Organization approval for its vaccines, which would open the door to its widespread adoption. Unlike the mRNA vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna, Cuba opted to develop a more traditional vaccine, as Nature explained recently. In developing Soberana 2, Veres Bencomo's group drew on its existing conjugate vaccine technology. Finalis conjugate vaccines take a protein or a sugar from a bacterium or virus and chemically link it to a harmless fragment of a neurotoxin protein from the tetanus bacterium. Conjugate vaccines against meningitis and typhoid are used around the world, and Cuba has been immunizing children with a vaccine of this type for years. The Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnologies of Dala vaccine is also making major strides. As with Soberana 2, the technology behind it is adapted from an existing vaccine, one for hepatitis B, that Cuba developed and has used for many years. Protein-based vaccines like Soberana 2 and Abdala come with multiple advantages. For one thing, Branco wrote, they can be kept in a fridge or even at room temperature, as opposed to the subpolar temperatures the Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at or the freezer temperatures Moderna's vaccine requires, making distribution easier, especially in developing countries and remote areas. Alluding to other vaccines' extreme cold storage requirements, Helen Yaff, senior lecturer in economic and social history at the University of Glasgow, told Branco that in the global south, where huge amounts of the population have no access to electricity, is just another technological obstacle. Moreover, because Cuba has relied on conjugate vaccines for many years to protect people, including children, from typhoid, Bencomo told Nature he is confident that Soberana 2, which has been used to inoculate nearly 2 million Cuban children so far, is safe across age groups. Branco noted the mRNA technology, which has never been used on kids before, has meant a lag between adult and child vaccination in the developed world, and means vaccines for kids under 5 are still being developed. Cuba, by contrast, aimed from the outset to create a vaccine that kids could take, he added. As of this month, it's fully vaccinated more than 4/5 of all kids aged 2 to 18. Arguably, the most important aspect of Cuba's vaccines, proponents say, is that their development demonstrates the existence of an alternative model for scientific research that puts people over profits. The Cuban vaccine, Yaff told Branco, is 100% entirely a product of a public biotech sector. Branco explained, while in the United States and other developed countries, life-saving medicines are developed thanks largely to public funding before their profits and distribution are ruthlessly privatized for corporate enrichment, Cuba's biotech sector is wholly publicly owned and funded. That means Cuba has decommodified a vital human resource, the exact opposite policy direction that we have seen in these last 4 decades of neoliberalism. Despite a crushing blockade by the United States government, responsible for a third of the world's pharmaceutical production, Cuba's biotech sector has thrived. It makes nearly 70% of the roughly 800 medicines that Cubans consume and 8 of the 11 vaccines in the country's national immunization program, and it exports hundreds of millions of vaccines a year. Their revenues are then reinvested into the sector.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our show aims to address the most important issues in the subcontinent, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will see how social media giants are censoring human rights abuses in Kashmir. And we will also take a look at how the year-long farmer protest in India has finally paid off.
As the Kashmiris live under a brutal occupation, recurring communications blockade and prolonged aura of fear embroiled by torture, extrajudicial killings and kidnappings, social media giants are turning a blind eye to the human rights abuses faced by the people of the Indian-controlled Kashmir, even now when tensions are high in Kashmir because of the authorities are using innocent civilians as human shields. A report by the Kashmiri human rights organization Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continually silenced Kashmir-related content. What's going on, and why is this happening? Take a look.
In August 2019, India's right-wing BJP government scrapped the autonomous status of Kashmir by revoking Articles 370 and 35A of the Indian Constitution as a part of Modi's campaign to take over the disputed territory. Internet was shut down, curfew was imposed, thousands of Indian troops were sent into the territory, and all opposing voices, including three former chief ministers of the state, were arrested. Even though curfews and internet blackouts were momentarily lifted, they have been regularly reinforced time and again. Up until today, there have been more than 300 instances of internet shutdowns in the disputed territory. But what's interesting is that even when the internet is available, social media conglomerates censor the voices of Kashmir which call for help. According to a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir titled How Social Media Corporations Enable Silence on Kashmir, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have been silencing Kashmir-related content since 2017. According to human rights groups, the human rights abuses in Indian-controlled Kashmir now range from mass killings, enforced disappearances, torture, rape, and sexual abuse to political repression and suppression of freedom of speech, but Kashmiris have no way to tell the world about the atrocities themselves.
It's funny how social media giants like Facebook are on one hand criticized for being too soft on hate speech content, while on the other, they are readily censoring voices which are merely found offensive by the US government. After the US martyred Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in cold blood, Facebook and Instagram accounts of all the uncountable number of journalists, activists, and common people who were posting in support of the slain general were shut down, and Facebook accepted that they had to comply with the requests of the US. Facebook did not even shy away from closing down the official account of Press TV, which is followed by 4 million people, simply because the US administration does not agree with it. Where's the freedom of speech, and is that all to do with the double standard policy of this monopoly?
A former Facebook product manager raised the alarm over the not-so-free and safe Facebook. Leaking a trove of internal company documents to the Wall Street Journal, Francis Haugen uncovered the real face of Facebook to the world, and the company tried to hide away from the controversy by hurriedly changing the name of its parent organization from Facebook to Meta. According to the leaked internal company documents, which are also referred to as the Facebook files, Facebook has been aware of hate speech and calls for violence against groups like Muslims and Kashmiris, including posts of photos of piles of dead Kashmiri bodies with glorifying captions on its platform in India, but still, none of their publishers were blocked. The leaks also reveal that for the past 3 years, Facebook has also been conducting internal research of how Instagram affects young users, and Facebook's own findings were that Instagram is harmful to a large portion of young users, where teenage girls were among the most harmed. Researchers within the company reported that we make body issues worse for 1 in 3 teenage girls. Shockingly, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The papers provide revelations regarding topics ranging from toxic Facebook algorithms and dangerous artificial intelligence software to meddling in internal politics of countries and spreading false information.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mrs. Naime Mahjur, a columnist at Independent Urdu. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mahjur. Now, a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continuously silenced Kashmir-related content. Now, do you think this is true?
I think it is, because it has also been confirmed by many international organizations, human rights organizations, as well as the journalist organizations, including Access Now and CPJ, and others as well. Human rights organizations has also given report about this. Even in many judicial cases in India, the courts have also admitted it. There are also colleagues of mine in journalist fraternity and other social rights organizations whose social media accounts still remain closed until today, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And you might have also seen that more than 1 million tweets of the account holders were held since 2019. Which had a mere, mention of Kashmir. This has also come in the public domain now. Since 5th of August 2019, when Jammu Kashmir was stripped of its semi-autonomous status, the region had no internet for the last 700 days. And even during the earliest period of COVID pandemic, when the internet was the lifeline of every single person to get information on how to deal with this pandemic. And in Kashmir, and it was total communication blockade. And then the majority of the population in Kashmir and Jammu and Kashmir, the whole region, considers these social media platforms, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, they are certainly, complicit with the government in Delhi in disabling the thousands of accounts or restricting the content if there is any mention of Kashmir. There was a recent survey by some social activists in Kashmir. They knew number of 600 account holders who are prominent journalists, social activists, human rights activists, and they don't have these accounts working now because they are totally closed. And there are artists even, artists, actors, academicians who are raising voice, across the globe. They are mostly the Kashmiri diaspora. They were raising voice on the appalling situations of human rights in Jammu and Kashmir. Their outreach capacity has been curtailed by these social media platforms. So because of these strict restrictions on local media, and then there's only one narrative of Kashmir's story by Indian mainstream media, it was only the social media which common people have access to or can share their apathy. When you also deprive them of this digital right that's given to 8 billion population of the world, and you can realize the sense of helplessness, hopelessness Kashmiris are going through at this time.
Now, dozens of people from the Sikh community also protested at the Facebook headquarters in California. They also claimed that Facebook and Instagram have been censoring content posted in support of the Indian farmers and about the Sikh community. Now, do you think there's a pattern to this?
Well, you can find this pattern in every part of India now. I mean, where minorities are facing intimidation and harassment every day. There are many reports that accounts and the content got disabled throughout the Paha farmers' agitation in the country, which is now running for the last 1 year. Recently, you might have seen the news, those viral videos also of Tripura, which is in northeast of India. And two social media handlers, including journalists, were slapped with the FIRs for tweeting ground reports on attacks on minorities and their religious places in Tripura. Some were arrested also, and there are many journalists which are still behind bars in Tripura. They haven't got even bail yet. Internet access was shut down there in Assam and Tripura, and still many are denied access to social media platforms. And then you might have also gone the story about this Amravati in Maharashtra, where Mumbai is the commercial capital of India, and there internet was shut down, social media was totally, shut down. There were restrictions all over media, and it's hard to get another shade of the story when you have got only one side of story from the mainstream media, which they get from the government itself.
Mrs. Mahjou, I forgot to ask, why is Facebook censoring content in Kashmir in the first place?
I don't have any answer for that, to be honest with you. I think this question needs to be asked to these social media platforms, because why are they taking sides of the government? I mean, maybe it is because of their own commercial interests, or there is a lot of bonhomie, or the influence of the friendly relations of these rulers. But this also negates the claim of the democracies that every citizen has a right to speak or write. This pick and choose policy of the governments as well as of these social media platforms. I mean, you are allowing some people to speak and you are depriving other people not to speak. That puts a huge question mark on the credibility and impartiality of these social media platforms, because they themselves claim that they are the champions of free speech. So social media giants have become, I think, most doubtful in the eyes of the public now. So they need to restore this confidence among the people that they are not taking sides with the governments, which people the general impression is that.
Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, Mrs. Mahjou. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the human rights abuses in Kashmir.
Khalid Baydun wrote, Instagram blocked his story when he tried to talk about crisis in Kashmir. Samir Yasir mentioned that the brutal killing of Shamima was underplayed by newspapers. Zabe tweeted no internet and communication facilities to be allowed in Kashmir, which is total breach with international law and ethics, and still the whole world is silent. What Tyler tweeted, Modi pays a lot and tried to silence the media regarding the crisis in Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In 2020, the BJP government led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi passed three controversial farm laws which sparked massive protests in the country. These laws essentially loosened rules that have protected India's farmers from the free market capitalists for decades. After a year of non-stop protests, the hard struggle of farmers has finally paid off. Modi has announced that the laws will be repealed. But what is it that led people to get angry with the laws in the first place?
The three laws being talked about are the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Act, the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement of Price Assurance and Farm Services Act, and the Essential Commodities Amendment Act. These laws, which were introduced in September 2020, were met with widespread angst and widespread disapproval from farmers, who took to the streets to launch a robust protest. The laws were basically meant to deregulate the sector, allowing farmers to sell produce to buyers beyond government-regulated wholesale markets, where growers are assured of a minimum price MSP. This would mean that small farmers would be put up against big businesses, who would then ultimately negotiate prices according to their own holding power. And free market prices would mean that farmers would also lose out on price support for staples such as wheat and rice. The protests, which started off in Punjab, ultimately spread like wildfire. Protesters joined forces together on the streets in a year-long rift with the government, something which is being called the longest agrarian movement in independent India. The protesters were prepared for the long haul right from day one. They set up camp, had trucks full of food and water, and a zealous spirit which kept them united. It is said that after 1 year and more than 700 lives lost during the protests, the protesters have finally won. However, laws are yet to be repealed in the parliament, and let's not decide everything at the drop of a hat.
The farmers from Punjab, who predominantly belong to the Sikh religious minority of India, were the first to grasp the danger when Parliament passed the three controversial bills in a great hurry without a discussion or taking farmers' unions into confidence. The Sikhs since led the farmers' protests in India. Interestingly, Modi made the announcement of backing down from his decision on the occasion of birth anniversary of Sikhism's founder Guru Nanak, whom the Sikhs all around the world follow religiously even after his death.
The Sikh population consists of almost 30 million people around the world, and between 22 million to 28 million live in India. Of those who live in India, around 80% reside in North Indian state of Punjab, which borders with Pakistan. The announcement comes few months before key elections in five provinces of India, one of which is Punjab, where majority of the population are Sikhs. The government BJP party is performing poorly in Punjab, and where earlier farmers had made it almost impossible for BJP leaders to campaign or even hold meetings with their workers in the state. The party is now expected to take credit for undoing a mistake and deciding to bow down before the farmers as it aims to woo the Sikhs who formed the majority vote bank in Punjab. That's not it, however. The Sikh community have had their own differences with the Indian establishment and right-wing organizations in India. From the Golden Temple massacre in 1984 to the present situation of minority rights, the memory of Sikhs in India is etched with a series of tragedies.